heard us, but the world didn't hear us. Thank you. Well, as you get settled, just please remember that the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent 15 minutes, and finally the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Whenever you're ready, just approach the microphone, adjust it to your level, and begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court, my name is Jessica Merz-Gaddis, and I represent Nicholas Thompson, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, this case is really very simple. Rule 2001, Subdivision 5A1, states that if a party files a written objection to a competency report within 10 days after receipt, the district court must hold a contested hearing. Respondent has conceded, and the record amply shows that Mr. Thompson timely filed a written objection to Dr. Wright's competency evaluation. Specifically, on December 11th, 2018, that evaluation was filed, and just 2 days later, on December 13th, Mr. Thompson filed a written objection.
I just want to cut to the chase. Mm-hmm. And so the remedy you are asking for is to send it back for a contested hearing.
Correct.
And what do you imagine that contested hearing will look like? I'm asking you to speculate.
Sure. Well, as the rule itself contemplates, a contested hearing would be one where both parties would be permitted to call witnesses and introduce evidence, just like any run-of-the-mill contested hearing would be, like a contested omnibus hearing would be.
But the state has conceded that your client's incompetent.
But Mr. Thompson has not.
Right.
And the rule, the rule doesn't specify that you only get a contested hearing.
No, I agree with you. I'm just asking you, so far he hasn't been able to find someone who opines that he is competent. So then would it be him taking the stand, saying I'm competent?
That's certainly one possibility. He would certainly have the right to testify at this hearing and provide that evidence.
What are the other possibilities? I'm just curious.
Sure. Well, I would agree with you that in this case there have been, most recently, there have been two evaluators who have evaluated him and reached the opinion that he was not competent.
Well, and it sounds like he's not really doing a whole lot where he is right now.
Well, if we could get to that in just a minute, I just want to dial you back just for a second to what your earlier question was in terms of what evidence might come in. I just ask you to recall that the record also reflects that part of the reason that the district court in this case sua sponte ordered a competency evaluation in the first place is because in the past there had been competency evaluations of a conflicting nature. One, in fact, had found him competent where one had opined that he was not. So that might be something that Mr. Thompson might want to introduce at a contested hearing.
But of course we know that competency isn't a one and done kind of thing. It's not static.
Correct.
You look at the person as they are today.
Correct. It's certainly fluid. So, but just to address your concern about what might this competency hearing look like, that might be something that he would want to introduce to compare and contrast, perhaps, the evaluator's methodology. These two evaluators who came to a conclusion that he was incompetent, how did their methodology compare to the evaluator who determined previously that he was, in fact, competent? Those are some of the ideas and issues that could be fleshed out at a contested hearing.
Was there anything proffered before the district court judge when there was a request made for the contested hearing? I know that the judge did ask, what do you intend to present or what do you have to say?
Well, I'd like to unpack your question a little bit because I think there's a couple of competing ideas going on there. The first thing I'd like to be clear about is, well, there's many things I want to be clear about. I'm not sure where to start. I don't think that anybody can fairly say that hearing that we're talking about, the February 20th hearing, that anybody thought of that as a contested hearing, as a chance for anybody to present any kind of evidence. And I think the reason that we know that is because the court actually states it's under the mistaken assumption that because the state had withdrawn its request for a contested hearing, that then necessarily one would not happen. So it wasn't thinking, nobody was thinking of this February 20th hearing as a contested hearing where evidence would be proffered. Beyond that, remember, too, that all the rule requires is that Mr. Thompson file a written objection.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the rule, because as I understand, the underlying purpose of the rule, isn't it, to protect a defendant who is incompetent from having to go to trial. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the underlying purpose of that rule?
I think so.
And the court has a duty to make sure that the court is not forcing incompetent people to defend themselves in a criminal matter and lose their liberty.
I agree with you, Your Honor.
And so aren't you kind of, with this argument, aren't you kind of turning that purpose on its head? Because here, the state is conceding. This man is incompetent. Based on all the evidence we have, the state, who is usually fighting on the other side of this issue, is conceding it here. So, within that context, why was the judge being unreasonable in this case when he had two experts who said he's incompetent? He's trying to protect this man's rights, and there's nothing in this record that I know of, but you can point it out, that indicates that he is competent. Other than his self-serving statement that I object, I guess. I mean, is that sufficient for a contested, remember it has to be a contested evidentiary hearing. Is that enough?
Yes. The written objection is all that's required by the rule, by the plain language of the rule, to trigger a contested hearing. The district court must hold.
Well, if we just view that in isolation without looking at the overall purpose of the whole system of rules.
No, Your Honor, looking at the plain language of the rule, following the plain language of the rule, the starting point is we have an evaluation. If you file a written objection, you get a contested hearing. That's where we start. Now, moving on to your second concern about the ultimate decision to be made following a contested hearing about competency versus incompetency, please recall that the defendant also has competing interests, too, of not being found incompetent and indefinitely committed, as he has been in this case. A criminal defendant also has the right to be tried if he is competent. He has the constitutional right to a trial, and he has a constitutional right to a speedy trial. So what we have in this case is the state charging Mr. Thompson with murder. Agreeing with an evaluator's opinion that he is incompetent, this triggers a finding of incompetence by the district court without any litigation and an indefinite commitment to St. Peter. What we know from the record now, he's been moved from St. Peter and he's back in the jail. Now he's indefinitely in the jail receiving no treatment. No, the criminal proceedings are suspended. There's no timeline here, no horizon for when he's going to have a trial, let alone a speedy trial.
But isn't that the whole purpose of this whole procedure, though, is if he achieves competency, that there's review hearings and they revisit the matter, they look at new evidence regarding the treating doctors as to whether they think he's at a competency level?
There are certainly review hearings that do happen as part of this process. Those don't address the problem that we started with, which is that there was never a contested hearing and never any litigation to determine whether he was or was not competent. Remember, a contested hearing in the first instance will be making a determination, is he incompetent? What the review hearing does is simply presuppose the validity of the underlying determination of incompetence and simply ask, has anything changed?
Well, and again, if you could, if there was evidence in the record that contests these competency evaluations, Is there evidence in this record?
Your Honor, the reason there is not is because he was denied the contested hearing at which he would have presented the evidence. That is the problem. What you're struggling with here is the fact that you're not seeing anything because our problem is that we weren't given the opportunity to put that into evidence.
And again, I mean, in a contested evidentiary hearing is when you have facts in dispute and they're being contested. And it's not uncommon when you have that situation for there at least to be an offer of proof. You know, he could have said, I've got my own psychologist that's been treating me for 20 years, and he says I'm competent. I mean, and I will bring him in, or just anything in this record that indicates there's actually something here to contest these facts, other than his own self-serving statement that I object.
Your Honor, if you want to characterize it that way, his own self-serving statement that he objects is all the rule requires. The rule says, Rule 2001, Subdivision 5, Paren A, Paren 1, if a party files a written objection to the competency report within 10 days after receipt, the district court must hold a contested hearing. Mr. Thompson did exactly and all the rule requires of him to trigger that contested hearing.
Ms. Kirsch, do you know what the presumptive commit is if he's convicted of the top count for second-degree intentional murder?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know that.
Presumably it's like 15 or 20 years or something.
I would think at least. I think second-degree intentional murder is a statutory max of 40 years.
So he's willing to roll the dice on that if he's found competent?
Mr. Thompson's position, absolutely. He has maintained clearly throughout this record that he is competent and he wants to have his trial. Now, of course, before we get to that point of the trial, our position is all we're at right here and all we're asking for is what the rule has entitled him to, which is the contested hearing where his competency is actually litigated. Now, it may be that following a contested hearing, the court comes to the same conclusion, and that's fine. The problem is here, and keep in mind, too, the other reason that what happened here isn't even anything close to a contested hearing is at this February 20th hearing, the court didn't even receive the evaluator's reports, right? When we think of a contested hearing and we're going to be introducing evidence, what we would think of here is even if the state would have to call the evaluators to lay the foundation, mark the evaluations, and if nothing else, introduce the evaluations as exhibits at this hearing from which then the court could make its determination. That didn't even happen here. Nobody thought that what was happening here was any kind of contested hearing, and the district court was under the mistaken understanding that it didn't have to hold any such hearing because the state had clearly withdrawn its request. At one point after the first evaluation, the state had objected, and the state likewise requested the hearing. So early in these proceedings, both parties wanted it. But then when the state changed its mind and withdrew its objection, suddenly the district court became very confused and thought that simply because the state had withdrawn its request, there was no need for a contested hearing, completely forgetting that Mr. Thompson had filed a written objection and very clearly maintained throughout that he had not withdrawn his objection.
And I'm just speculating, but Judge Bentz was the public defender down in Jackson County, so she may have had some familiarity with Mr. Thompson.
I have no information
it's
to
not in the record, but
confirm or deny that, Your Honor. Yeah. Although, now that you mention it, now that I think about it, it does seem that, if I'm remembering right from some of the earlier transcripts, I believe Judge Bentz was familiar with the fact that Mr. Thompson had competency evaluations before. That's what prompted the competency evaluation in this case. I guess I'm just not clear about whether she knew that in her judicial or counsel capacity.
Usually throughout our judicial system, though, you don't have contested evidentiary hearings unless there's a contested fact. And here, I'm just looking for anything in the record that indicates there are contested facts. I mean, You just can't say, because I've had incompetent people before me in district court that literally couldn't even hardly put a sentence together. And according to your view, as long as they say, I object, and they write it on a piece of paper, they get a full-blown evidentiary hearing on contested facts, which we don't know what they are. Are you suggesting that this, anytime there's any objection, anytime under any circumstances, that the state and the taxpayers have to pay for two psychiatrists to come in, and they have to pay for the court hearing, no matter what the circumstances are? And I guess is that what you're asking for, a bright line rule?
I'm simply asking for the court to follow the bright line rule that's laid out in Rule 2001, Subdivision 5, Paren A, Paren 1. It's not my view that he's entitled to a contested hearing. It's the rule's requirement that he's entitled to a contested hearing because he has filed a written objection within 10 days of receipt of the evaluator's report. I'm just asking the court to follow the rule. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Karen McGillick from the Attorney General's Office here on behalf of the state of Minnesota.
Well, can I just start there? Because, that's a real easy case for us. If we just look at that rule, it says what it says.
Absolutely, and I don't dispute the rule.
And why shouldn't we just follow the rule and that be the end of it and not concern ourselves with the purpose of the rule or what's underlying this whole scheme?
Well, contrary to what opposing counsel has stated, the state has not conceded that Mr. Thompson filed a timely written objection to the reports in this case. The only timely written objection that was ever filed was to the first examiner's report, Dr. Wright, and that was filed through his counsel on December 13th of 2018. But with that objection, the cover letter that counsel included when counsel filed that on his behalf said, specifically, the counsel was requesting a hearing to address some administrative matters prior to any contested Rule 20 hearing being set. So at the time that written objection was made, contemporaneous with it, we have a letter from defense counsel saying, yes, he's making an objection, but we want an administrative hearing to be scheduled first. And that hearing was then scheduled. Now, prior to that, the state then filed its own objection and a motion for a second examination. And the parties proceeded to that January 9th hearing, with the assumption that would be a motion hearing to hear the state's request for a second examination and to determine that before deciding whether or not there should be a contested hearing. At the point that the court granted the state's motion for a second examination, it becomes moot whether or not there was an objection to the Dr. Wright's original examination because this was now being set on for a second examination. So there would be no point in holding a contested hearing at that stage in the proceedings when clearly the state is going to have him reexamined by a second evaluator, and that's what happened after the January 9th hearing. Now, at this point, we move forward to whether or not there was ever a timely written objection to the second examiner. I always feel like I'm going to say the name wrong. Is it Dr. Preschold? Is that how you would pronounce it? Preschold. What we have was a handwritten letter that was submitted on the 5th of February objecting, but that was a premature objection. The rule requires it be filed within 10 days after receipt of the examiner's report. And when he filed that letter, she hadn't even issued her report yet, so that cannot trigger the rule. Now, on February 12th and 13th, at that point, the prosecutor is withdrawing his objection, and he and defense counsel are both asking to proceed to an uncontested competency hearing.
I just didn't get that out of the record, can you point me to where
Absolutely.
The defense counsel agreed it was an uncontested competency hearing?
Yes. The prosecutor's letter, I think it helps to start with what the prosecutor said and then the defense counsel respond, which is document 111 in the record. States that the prosecutor is asking that the court set a hearing at its earliest convenience to make a competency determination and noted that he would be relying solely on the examiner's report rather than live testimony. That is essentially asking for what occurs under subdivision 5 of the rule, which is where you will just be asking for a competency determination that is uncontested based on the evaluator's report. Following that letter, defense counsel submitted also on February 13th, document 112, which says, we are in receipt of the prosecutor's letter regarding the withdrawal of the objections, and you can read in the word withdrawal of the request for a competency hearing. We join in that request and ask the court administration contact counsel with available dates. So at this point on February 13th, we have defense counsel and the prosecutor both asking the court, acknowledging there's been a withdrawal of a request for a contested hearing and asking to schedule a date for an uncontested hearing.
I think if the letter indicates that Thompson was generally joining the state's request for a competency hearing. I don't read that it's joining the state's request or joining the state's withdrawal of the objection.
I mean, the way the letter is phrased, we're in receipt of the prosecutor's letter regarding withdrawal of the objections and request for a hearing. We join in that request. To me, that's a very clear statement that we also agree that the state is withdrawing its request for a contested hearing. We join in that request, and we ask you to set it on for a hearing.
I think it's more ambiguous than your reading of it.
Okay. And that may be the case, but at any whether regardless, I guess, on how we read that letter, on February 14th, the court schedules a hearing for February 20th. And at that point in time, when we look at the date of February 14th, when that was scheduled, there was no new written objection that had been timely filed by Mr. Thompson.
But by timely, you just mean that the judge jumped the gun on him and got the order out before the 10 days, right?
I'm back up before the February 20th hearing. I'm talking about just scheduling that hearing. So we have the second examination's report is filed on February 12th, okay? The parties receive it on the 12th. The 12th is the same date that the state withdraws its request for a contested hearing and withdraws its objection. And on the 13th, both parties submit a letter asking the court to set it on for a hearing. I'm going to read it as saying for an uncontested hearing, but I understand that you may disagree
but
with that.
But we still have
but at that point,
outstanding request to contest the first psychological evaluator's report.
But again, when you read that letter, now that was, again, a letter that was filed through his counsel with a cover letter from his counsel saying, here's his objection, but we want an administrative hearing first before anything is scheduled, and then that administrative hearing resulted in a second examination. So while it's floating out there that he had objected to Dr. Wright's, we at this point don't have any follow-up request for an objection to Dr. Preschold's second examination. And I think you have to read the original December 13th objection with the cover letter that was filed with counsel saying, yes, we want this other stuff to happen first. And again, you have to consider what the purpose of these proceedings are. It's not to try an incompetent person. There's a presumption of incompetence that the party challenging that needs to overcome. That's a protective goal of the criminal justice system, not to put someone on trial who's not competent. So, you know, everybody's proceeding under the idea that this is what's best for him. He may not understand that due to his mental condition, but it was proceeding forward with, now we have gotten a second opinion that confirms the first opinion. The state's going to concede, okay, I guess he's not competent. I mean, the state wanted to try him for this murder, but they had to concede that on the available evidence.
Well, maybe you will.
Maybe.
I mean, if that's what you want.
But my point being, there was no written objection to the second examiner's report at the time.
Well,
that the
I mean, at the end of the day, let's say I agree with Judge Riley that I think this guy has been loud and clear that he wants his hearing for whatever reasons. Clearly, if we can assume the evidence is what the evidence is, unless he finds some evaluator or just, you know, appears amazingly articulate and sane on the stand, he's going to be found incompetent. But at the very least, according to counsel for the appellant, you know, he feels very strongly about this and he wants his hearing. So why not give it to him?
Because at the time that the judge made her determination at that February 20th hearing, she did not have it, from every appearance in the record, did not have this written letter.
But
finally, eventually did get filed on the 20th in front of her. It is very clear when you read her order, when she sets out the procedural posture of her case and the order, it's included in the appellant's addendum, that there is zero reference to this letter that came in. And when you look at the way that it's logged into Mensis and you look at the fact that it was obviously hand-stamped, there's facts outside the record about when jail staff usually will deliver mail to the courthouse and how that all occurred. I can get into that if you want, but it is outside the record. But there's every reason to believe that at the time that this decision was made, that the judge wasn't aware that there was ever a written letter on the 20th. And if she doesn't know that there's a written letter and he makes no reference to it at the hearing and his defense attorney makes no reference, the fact that a defendant is objecting isn't what the rule requires. It requires a timely filed written objection within 10 days. And there was no such written objection to this second examination. And I don't think we can go back to the first
letter. But the problem here is he had 10 days under the rules, right?
Correct.
And he did get an objection in within 10 days. But unfortunately, the judge got her order out before the 10 days was up.
Right.
Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
And even in her order, she says in finding number 11, she says Thompson stated he objected to being found incompetent. So we have here a situation where within he timely filed the objection. He just didn't know the judge was going to not give him the 10 days he was allowed under the rules. Isn't that the situation?
I think that is fair. And I think this is one of the reasons this case is not your typical competency case and why it's almost difficult
to look at. Well, I think we all agree with that.
Law. You know, we don't have defense counsel in this case advocating for the same position as the client. So obviously
who,
everyone was aware.
But on that very point, whose call is it?
The client.
I mean, it's the client.
Absolutely.
Right. And he's pretty adamant, you know, for whatever his reasons, he wants to declare that he was perfectly sane when he killed his mother.
Right.
And you know what? Okay. Seems odd to me, but, I mean, outside of the waiver issue, what's your argument for affirming?
My argument would be this. Number one, when we look at a technical violation like this, now if we're going to say that there was...
Okay, let's say I don't believe it's a technical violation. If he objects, he gets his hearing. So let's say I don't buy that either, speaking for myself only.
Okay, so let me backpedal a little bit. What opposing counsel's position has been is this very strict reading of the rule. If you object within 10 days, you get a hearing. I don't think it's possible that we cannot look at the procedural posture of this case to say that if the written objection comes in after defense counsel and the state have all proceeded to a hearing, I'm not going to suggest that the parties were not aware at the hearing that he was continuing to object. But I don't think anybody was aware at the time of the hearing and at the time of the competency determination, which was made on the record at that 11 a.m. hearing. I don't think that they were aware that this letter was out there that would eventually be filed at court admin. It appears to have happened later that day. So we have a decision that has now already been made. Now, if technically he filed that letter within 10 days and we want to say that that is a violation, I think the idea, you know, it has been suggested that this is a structural error. I don't think there's any support in case law to find that this would be a structural error. It would be subject to a harmless error analysis, and there is every reason for this court to affirm by applying the harmless error standard and to say that if we were to remand at this point for a hearing, there would not be any difference because although he may not have
come... What if he suddenly gets somebody from Mayo to say, you know what, he is sane. He's on his meds now. You know, and he comes in there and, you know...
Well, the evidence
seems to be articulate and then says, and you know why? My mother was trying to kill me, so that's why I killed her. So it's self-defense. I mean, maybe he wants to make this argument. I don't know.
I mean, he had the opportunity to address the court at the February 20th hearing. He could have pro-offered any such evidence. He could have said, either through counsel or pro se, we intend to have a third examination. We intend to bring in evidence that I'm competent. He didn't do that. He never offered anything to rebut the presumption of incompetence that was established by the state's evidence. Now, this record in this case shows that for this particular defendant, you know, since he's been civilly committed, there have been, at the time I wrote the brief, there had been two competency review hearings under Rule 20. I think there have now been three. And in every case, the evidence showed that he was failing to participate in, he would not comply with additional examinations. The examiners even commented that for somebody who wants to prove them competent, you would think he would follow through with the competency evaluations, but he won't. My understanding is he's been transferred to the jail because of his unwillingness to cooperate with medication and his threatening behavior.
But then it just sounds like an easy hearing for the state.
I'm sorry?
It just sounds like an easy hearing for the state.
And perhaps it would be, but, you know, at this point, I think the idea that this is a harmless error that would not result in any difference would allow this court to affirm what happened here, which is where a district court made a decision without any evidence that there had been a written objection based on undisputed evidence in the record that there was a findings of incompetency. There is nothing in the record to suggest that this is a harmless error that would then result in the same thing if this court were to remand back, and certainly you can. I'm sure we would prevail at a remand hearing, but I think this is exactly why there's a harmless
error. But then, and even if you did prevail, and then at least Mr. Thompson would feel that, you know, he had due process and his rights are vindicated, so I don't know, maybe he'll calm down at St. Peter. I mean, isn't that something good, too?
I don't know how he'll behave. I know he's been transferred out of the hospital due to his behavior and his unwillingness to cooperate with any type of process. I don't see on the facts in this record how he could establish competency. But the point being, we don't normally just, if there's an error, remand when we can say that that error is harmless. And this is a very strong case for harmless error when there is absolutely nothing in the record to show that there would be a different outcome. Had the judge been aware on the 20th that he was going to file that letter later that day, what would have been different about that hearing if she had scheduled a competency hearing to take place a week later? We don't have any evidence that there would have been a different outcome. And that is exactly where harmless error would allow this court to affirm. If there are no other questions, I will rely on the arguments in my brief and ask this court to affirm for those grounds.
Thank you. Thank you,
Your Honors.
Counsel. We'll finally hear from counsel for the appellant, please.
Your Honor, there's three points I want to make on rebuttal, but I'm sorry, I see my time is not clicking yet. Okay. There are three points I want to make on rebuttal, but before I get to those three substantive points, I do take issue with counsel's representation to this court that Mr. Thompson was transferred out of St. Peter due to his bad behavior. There's nothing in the record that reflects that. We have a notice that reflects that that St. Peter did a reduction of custody and sent him back to the jail. We have nothing in this record. It's due to his bad behavior, and I take objection to that being stated before this court. The three substantive points as to the issue before this court that I want to make are, respondent offers you no authority for the suggestion that Mr. Thompson's first written objection to Dr. Wright's report was somehow rendered moot by the fact that there was going to be a second evaluation. Remember that all the rule requires is that he file the written objection within 10 days to the court-ordered competency evaluation. That's what he did. The only reason that there was a second evaluation in this case at all is because the state requested one. Now, Mr. Thompson objected to that second one, but that's really, for this point now, really neither here nor there. The point is, he didn't have any obligation under the rule, and counsel points you to no authority for the suggestion that he had an additional obligation to file another objection to the second state-requested evaluation when he had already done so to the court-ordered evaluation and had never withdrawn that. The second point I want to make is that the state offers you no authority for the proposition that harmless error review would apply here. I've pointed you to cases where the court has, when the district court has not strictly complied with the requirements of Rule 2001, has sent the case back without harmless error review. We know that structural error is a defect in the trial mechanism here, and I cannot imagine anything more defective than not giving a contested hearing. This isn't a matter of trial error issues subject to harmless error review. This is the fundamental defect in not giving a contested hearing on the issue of Mr. Thompson's competency. The third point I want to make is to the suggestion that somehow Mr. Thompson failed to proffer any evidence of his competency at this February hearing. Please keep in mind, and as I've pointed out to you in the brief, that it's an open question whose burden it is to prove Mr. Thompson's competency. He had absolutely no obligation anywhere in these proceedings to prove his competency. That's not his burden. That hasn't been established. I've cited to you in my brief the footnote from the Supreme Court in the Curtis case where they specifically say that it's an open question who has the burden of proof when the state is the party challenging the defendant's competency. And that's what we have here. The state is the party challenging the defendant's competency. So this court doesn't need to decide for purposes of this appeal who on remand would have the burden to prove his competency. That's still an open question, and that's something that the parties can fight out below. Also in Curtis, the third footnote talks about a split in authority. Different jurisdictions do it different ways. We don't have to figure that out right now. That's a fight for another day. But I just want to remind the court that it's a red herring to suggest that Mr. Thompson did anything wrong here by not proffering any kind of evidence of his competency, because the rule didn't require it, and it's not settled that would have been his burden in any event. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Please give my warmest regards to Ms. Rankin.
I will, thank you.
Our next case is some consolidated appeals, State of Minnesota.